Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
This is Severin, this is Greenhorns Radio, and it's raining here in Hudson. We are preparing for a big event this weekend at the Clearwater Festival. We're going to be making spelted blankets and seltzer, old-fashioned seltzer drinks from homemade syrup. And so it's a seltzer felting tent, which may sound very difficult, but it's easy to say. Anyway, so here we are. It's another episode, and I'm talking with Paul. How's it going over there?
Well, things are good. We have a little bit of smoke in New Mexico from the fires down south, but it's warm and dry, and we're hoping for some afternoon thunderstorms.
So let's give a little introduction to your part of the country and then to your operation.
Yeah.
Just as a way of introduction.
Sure. Well, I'm out in the mountains of New Mexico. And so a lot of people from back east, when they think about New Mexico, they think about desert and cactus and roadrunners and all of that. And certainly we have all that in the central and southern part of the state. But the northern part of New Mexico, think more like Colorado. It's the southern spur of the Rocky Mountains called the Sangre de Cristos. And our farm is located at an elevation of 7,300 feet. The mountains that I'm looking out at right now go to over 13,000 feet. We get just 12 inches of rain, and it's very sparsely populated out here in New Mexico. We have, we're the fifth largest state in the union, and we have fewer people than Brooklyn. So it's just wide open country and beautiful skies and.
Oh, gosh, your elevation just made me sneeze. It so must be really freaking cold in the winter.
It is. 2 years ago, we hit minus 27 Fahrenheit.
Holy moly.
That's unusual. You know, normally we hit just about minus 6 every year. And we figure we plant for about zone minus 15 if we're doing perennials and stuff like that. So it's mountain agriculture. It's we have an 87-day growing season. Our last frost here was just a couple of days before Memorial Day. And then usually right around the first week of September, we'll get a killing frost, and then it'll warm up, and we'll have Indian summer for another 6 weeks.
Whoa, holy smokes. That's short. That's really short. Wow. So there you are, but you decided to be in this. You decided to be there for a reason,
right?
Presumably. And what was that reason?
Well, I ended up in Taos really because I was looking for a small town with an international feel that was in the United States but not like the United States. I didn't really want to be an expatriate. I tried that, and I thought, well, let's find a slower pace of life. I actually grew up in Los Angeles, and my education was actually in computer engineering. And I worked for the very first .com, which was Symbolics.com. And that first .com was 1985. And I worked, it was a spinoff from the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab. So I was working with them, and we were out in Los Angeles designing another computer. Eventually, I just sort of tired of all of the technology, and I ended up buying a place in Taos, and so I would telecommute.
I don't want to cut you off, but I can't hear anything, so I'm going to ask the next question. No, it's not your fault. Do you? Now I hear you again.
That's good.
Oh, grumble. They're having radio. The radio transmission is having problems. But so let's talk a little bit about your growing practices since you're up so high. And you're committed to a lot of big ideas. How does How does that translate into the everyday? And can you just walk us through some of your irrigation system and cultivation and just logistics of that?
Sure. So the only way that you can make it work under these conditions is through protected culture. So you have to have some kind of protection to make it work. So we have three different things that we do. We have a line of microgreens that is produced year-round, and that uses artificial light and is, you know, completely environmentally controlled. And then we also do a produce crop of tomatoes that's just ripening up actually right this week. And that is in a heated greenhouse, but all of the irrigation water for that greenhouse is captured rainwater. Because when I bought this property, I wasn't farming. I was actually still in the realm of computers, and I just bought it because it had a pretty view. But the well on the property is 935 feet deep. So it really wasn't suitable for agriculture. I mean, the entire property really wasn't suitable for agriculture. But when you, you know, come from a permacultural perspective, you just start with what you have, and you work with what you have, and you figure out how to make it work. So back 10 years ago, when I built the first greenhouse, I designed a system that would capture all of the rainwater off of the residential house plus off the greenhouse. So in an area where we get only 12 inches of rain, we can capture 45,000 gallons in an average year.
Holy moly, so, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's amazing how much you can catch. And imagine, you know, somewhere like the East Coast where you have a lot of rain, then you're in a situation where, you know, that 45,000 would be 180,000 in New York. So
easily.
It's amazing how much water is available right out of the sky. And the nice thing about that water is it's very pure. There's almost nothing in it. So you certainly in the West, a lot of the problems you have on the farms is that the soils are salting up from over-fertigation or over-irrigation, I should say. And so if you're able to use the rainwater, you can really put a stop to that salting of the soil.
So you're using the rainwater, you're growing tomatoes and microgreens, and then what's the third part of your operation?
The third thing we do is we do a whole line of organic herb and vegetable starts for the natural food stores so that the home gardeners, if they want to put in a vegetable garden and they want that to be an organic garden, they can go in front of the supermarket and they can buy their starter plants that are certified organically grown. And we have, you know, we're in seven cities in New Mexico doing that. So it's nice for us because we have such a short growing season in the mountains that everything gets planted in a four-week period. But in southern New Mexico, they plant early because it gets too hot. So we start by shipping plants down to the border of Mexico, really. I mean, we're down in Las Cruces in the stores down there. And as the weather warms, the stores down south are done planting. Then the stores in the middle of the state are planting. And then we end up, actually, the last place they plant is higher up in the mountains than us, and they plant on the 4th of July.
So between the three of those enterprises, you have a little bit of diversity, you have a little bit of safety in that. You're serving the needs of others. And is this enough to support one or two people, or how many of you are living off of these little acres in this high mountain?
Well, we have seasonally there are three employees plus myself, and then year round there is myself plus one other person. So we're definitely supporting two people year round. and we have a little bit of extra help in the spring. So somebody's we've got two more people with seasonal jobs.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, and amazing that you could do that off of rainwater.
In the desert, in a mountain desert.
Exactly.
So if you can do it here, you can do it anywhere. And when you're looking around at the market around, at the market and at the landscape around you in Taos and New Mexico, northern New Mexico, where do you see opportunity? Do you see on many other, it seems like you've gone out and snooped around and figured out a couple of niche markets. And greenhouse tomatoes and microgreens and veggie starch, those are, in fact, those are the three crops that we specialize in at Monk's Hood Nursery, which is where I work, and because they're good little nooks. If you don't mind sharing, what are some other nooks you might want to clue people into?
Well, I think that I think there's going to be a big market coming up in the live herb business. You know, you see in all the stores the fresh cut herbs. People have transitioned from the dry herbs to the fresh cut, but you're getting these little 2/3 ounce packets at a high price, and the plastic involved probably weighs as much as the herbs, if not more. So if you look at what's happening in Europe, the seed breeders over in Europe are creating more compact herb varieties, and people have really transitioned away from the fresh cut to the live herbs, and they'll just buy a new plant customarily all the time. It's just routine for them in Europe. And so I see that as kind of an up-and-coming market in the U.S.
Yeah, I'm always shocked by the prices on those little, in the Whole Foods, those little clamshells for like $4. And it's only enough herbs for like 1.5 omelets.
Right.
But so you're saying people would just buy a little potted plant and keep it in their kitchen?
Yes.
And then cut and come again a little bit?
Exactly. Well, you know, there's not that much come again on it. It's more like cut and use, but you're getting more product for your dollar. And it's fresher because it's, it's still live when you're cutting it to use it. The expectation is, well, I'll just have this plant for 3 weeks. I'll eat it down to nothing, and then I'll go pick up another one.
And maybe they'll get into gardening along the way.
Yes, I would hope so. You know, those, I hope they don't do it by trying to transplant those because they're really bred to just be harvested. They probably would not transplant well. But it does, once people realize that they can actually keep a plant alive, I think it actually surprises a lot of people at first. And then I think what people don't realize is that if you go back enough generations in your family, there was a farmer there in everyone's family. Because at some point, everyone farmed. And so we have that sort of familial heritage, and we have that genetic heritage as farmers. Everybody has the capability. And so it's just a matter of people, like, regaining the knowledge to be able to do more of that.
Yeah, and having faith and stamina enough to brave through the learning process.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I think about it a lot, particularly on the start side. You know, I want people to have a success when they get our plants. And so we have to make sure that we have something that is really going to be a strong plant and that is adapted to our environment here. So we're always doing trials. You know, the varieties of tomatoes that we grow here are completely different than what you would be growing in New York.
Well, we are growing a lot of cherry tomatoes because they are such good sellers.
Yeah, but they do well for us.
Yeah. But you guys have, when I was down there in Arizona, there was a lovely lady and she was breeding plants. She was breeding, or she was keeping, saving seed and propagating and selling potted tomatoes that were native to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Or were kind of Mexican adapted tomato varieties. Is that kind of what you're talking about? What are the characteristics of those?
Well, for us, we're always looking for short season varieties, because what happens is down south, they'll plant in February, and by the time it's May, the temperatures are over 100 degrees. So tomatoes over 86 have a hard time setting fruit, and they have a hard time creating lycopene. So you end up with blotchy ripening on your existing fruit, and you get just a lot of blossom drop because of temperature. So down south, they want to do short season varieties because it gets hot too quickly. Now here up in the mountains, it gets too cold too quickly. And so again, you want short season varieties so that things will ripen up and you can get a harvest before you have your first frost. You know, a lot of people have to run around and pick everything green the first week of September when the frosts come. So we're looking at usually smaller size tomatoes. The cherry tomatoes are great. The salad size tomatoes are great. And the bigger things, like, you know, the 2-pound Brandywines and the beefsteaks and stuff like that, that are, you know, 90 days, 100 days to harvest, those are much more of a challenge in our climates here.
So you're eating tomatoes up on your mountain and the microgreens. Tell us what else is happening in New Mexico that might attract other young farmers to the state, or those who are from New Mexico and who've moved away, to entice them back. What's kind of like bopping?
Yeah. What is the big scene in New Mexico right now? Well, the amazing thing about what we have going on now versus 10 years ago is we now have distribution networks set up, and we've got CSAs set up that'll you don't have to have your own CSA. You can sell to existing CSAs. So we have amazing marketing opportunities here that I don't know is so well organized in other areas. We have such long distance to market, being such a big state with a low population. We have to figure out, you know, once you grow the crop, how do you get it to market and sell it? Well, we have distribution networks set up now so that from a percentage of invoice, you can get your product delivered all over the state. So we have access to all of the natural food stores. We have access to the CSAs. And we have a very vibrant farmers market scene. The local food movement is just getting bigger and bigger all of the time here. And there's plenty of, you know, if you want to lease land to farm, it's easy here. There's so much land that people want to be farmed because that's how you preserve your water rights. And water rights are just so precious here in the arid Southwest.
So there's good access to land, there's good markets, there's a lot of bicycle culture and alternative culture, and people are into outdoors, and that man just walked away with plants without paying for them. Can you chase him down? Here he is. He's looking how to pay. He's looking in our window. You see him over there? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm doing too many things at once. What are you experiencing in terms of shifts in the climate, or are you experiencing any?
Well, we had the warmest spring on record for sure. We're so used to climate variability here that it doesn't really look that different. We're just used to that all the time. You know, we have. Our 12-inch annual precipitation is a plus or minus 50%. So some years we might get 6, and some years we might get 18. But we have, Taos is really a big hotbed of alternative architecture and alternative energy as well. So because Taos became a big, back to the land movement back in the 70s when the hippies were all coming, we've got an ecological consciousness up here in northern New Mexico that you don't necessarily see in other parts of the country. The earth ships come from the Taos area. So there's lots of passive solar architecture. Adobe and Cobb are living traditions that never really stopped here. Lots of straw bale construction. There's amazing stuff happening with the green building side as well as on the farming side. So it's actually a pretty exciting place to be. That said, a lot of the young people that are from this area are not necessarily the ones that are so much into that. And we have a big brain drain happening in the mountains here where the younger people end up in Denver or Phoenix or Albuquerque instead of, because they grew up in the small town and they want to see more of the world. But eventually everybody comes back. So we're definitely keeping the fires burning, I should say, and keeping agriculture going. And it's the number of small farms has grown extraordinarily up in our region, but they're all really on the small side. I would say the $5,000 annual sales or the $10,000 annual sales size. And so that's why I'm always trying to push for people to start using the distribution networks and to increase their production so that they can actually make a living doing this rather than having to have a day job or a seasonal job and then farming to just supplement their income. Make it a way of life. It's definitely possible. I've been able to do it.
Well, you're sending a very powerful example, and I wish I could come visit, but maybe we'll just have to look at you on the internet. How do we find you? How do those who are listening find your? How do they find out more and learn about your operation?
Well, a Google search brings up more than going to our website. ChefsEdition.com is our website, and that's edition as in E-D-I-T-I-O-N, Chef's Edition. That's our brand name. But if people just do a Google search on Paul Cross tomatoes, you're going to find all kinds of stuff. We've got a lot of attention over the years, particularly because this is the week that people plant their tomatoes outside, and everyone is just dying for a good tomato because they haven't had a good one since last October. And just at the time that they're putting theirs in, ours from the greenhouse are ripe and ready to eat. And so we have this huge following in the spring where people are just so appreciative of having, healthy, organic, amazing, big, delicious tomatoes. That we've had a lot of press coverage over the years because of that, and it's all available when you do a Google search.
Right on. Well, here's to the future. May there be many famous tomato moments. And thank you so much for joining.
All right, Severin. It's been fun. Thank you.
Thank you. So this is another radio of Greenhorn Radio. And I want to make sure we tell everybody that we have a brand new website out for Greenhorns, thanks to the Future Farmers out of San Francisco, California, who designed it. And quite a lot of events coming up. We had our early summer hiatus of event programming because of just getting everything in the ground and trying not to go crazy. But now, of course, we have begun scheduling again. So tune in to the events calendar if you're in the New York area, consider coming up on the train this coming weekend for an amazing folk festival called Clearwater, where we will be having a seltzer fest. We're making felt, and we're making seltzer, and we're making soda, and then we've also got an agrarian stage with a Pocatello band and the Free Spirit, Anyway, there's music. Check it out online, and see you soon next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.